Hey, Larry.
Hi there, Andy.
How's it going tonight?
I've been
Good.
better, but I'm having a great day. It could be a lot worse, so look at the positive.
You are Mr. Absolute Mr. Negative every time.
No, I'm saying I'm having a great day. It could be a lot worse.
Yes. Please consider making us part of your podcast diet. You can find us at Registry Matters on your smart speaker or podcast app of choice, like Google Podcasts or Apple Podcasts. Also, if you like what you hear, please write a review. If you don't, forget everything I just said. You can support us at patreon.com/registrymatters. Well, we have a guest joining us tonight, Josh B. Ho. Josh is the co-host of the podcast Decarceration Nation, which is a podcast about radically changing the way America does criminal justice. He's recently interviewed gubernatorial candidates in Michigan and book authors on criminal justice reform. Josh is also a published author and hard charging on his Bars to Ballots campaign. Welcome to the Registry Matters podcast, Josh.
Thanks, Andy. Good to be here.
Great.
I'm also registering. I probably should mention that.
well, that's what we're here to talk about. We're privileged to have you here. A couple, I don't know what it was, a month or maybe 2 months ago, we received a comment about a formerly incarcerated person not being able to vote. And that wasn't just from the registry side, but just anybody that has a felony record. And which on the podcast we covered that we pointed to, I don't know, it's like 40 states where you can get your voting rights back to some degree. And you have this initiative, Bars to Ballots. And I was hoping that you could share those details with us.
Yeah, so as you just mentioned, in most states, at some level, people who are formerly incarcerated and even some people who are incarcerated can still vote. It depends on the state and what the rules are. And, after several years of, banging my head against the wall about criminal justice reform, I mean, stuff gets done. And I definitely enjoy being an activist, and it's something that matters a lot to me because I'm formerly incarcerated and because I'm a registrant. But the frustrating thing about it is you see a lot of incrementalism, and in truth, a lot of the incrementalism is really regressivism. And what I mean by that is that a lot of times the reform does harm to more incarcerated and formerly incarcerated people than it helps. And so I thought about it a lot, and I started becoming a lot more openly politically active, not just as an activist, but also in party and stuff like that. And so I got myself made a delegate. I went to the nominating committee and I found that none of them were talking about any of the stuff that I thought was important. And so I thought about it some more and I decided, well, I wonder how many people are formerly incarcerated. And so I talked to some of my friends at the Brennan Institute and a couple of other places, and I found out that there's about 12 to 14 million people who are either incarcerated or formerly incarcerated. And as we said before, many of them can vote at some level. And so my thought was, well, how can we start getting people so that they all, at least in one area, at least in the area of our shared interest, start being more politically active? And my thought was is that at the very least, we should all vote and where we can, and that if we vote, we should only vote for people, candidates who support real criminal justice reform. The second part of the platform is really just to try to get the vote for everyone who doesn't have the vote. And then there's some other like more technical things, like things that you can do to try to get your candidates on the record. There's some stuff that, right now we're really just kind of at the educational stage of the program where I'm just trying to let people know that we're starting this. And I've started to try to network with a bunch of the other organizations that work on criminal justice reform and stuff like that. It's going okay so far. That's
Larry,
pretty much it.
you bring up about, I'll just say, our people, in their lack of willingness, lack of fortuitousness to get involved. Here's the example of someone really taking the reins.
Yeah, well, I mean, I feel like one thing that I've really learned over the time is that no one else is going to get up and do it for us. At some cases, even in the case of like Doe's versus Snyder, the ACLU did an awful lot of work, but so did a lot of registrants. The University of Michigan Law School did a lot of work, but so did a lot of registrants. Plus all the people who were the people who were named in the case, the Does, were obviously registrants as well, and it had direct impact on them. And I feel like just in general, right now politicians feel like that criminal justice reform, regardless of the kind, that that they'll be for it to a certain extent, but there's really no penalty for them to ever be tough on crime or tough on criminals. And the only way we can change that is by demonstrating that we vote and that our votes have impact. And we can only do that if we start turning out.
Larry?
I agree with you, Josh. Unfortunately, as I've been in this movement for the better part of a decade now, I find that all of our people, when you do an analysis of which way they lean politically, too many of them lean toward the conservative side and vote for the people who want to continue to hammer down. They'll justify that by they'll have to look at the bigger picture, and they'll say things like, well, yes, criminal justice reform is important, but it's also important about keeping the border safe. And it's also important about prayer in the schools. It's also important about, and they'll go down a litany of conservative things. And then at the end of the day, they say they can't just vote for this issue. You're advocating that they vote, that if I just heard you correctly and looked at your platform, that if they cannot side on to real criminal justice reform, which means fewer people in prison, that you don't endorse these candidates. And that sounds like a single issue. And our people have not indicated to me in the last 10 years that they're willing to forego their vote for people that they find to be darlings on everything else.
Yeah, so here's the thing on that. The first thing is, I don't care what jacket someone wears. If I walk in and I talk to a candidate who's a Republican and they're good on criminal justice reform against a Democrat who's not, you know, we're on registry reform against a candidate who's not, I'm voting for the Republican, even though I'm traditionally a Democrat. And you're right, this single issue thing is kind of odd for a lot of people, and I understand that. But what impacts our lives more directly as formerly incarcerated people or as registrants than this issue? You know, I'm not saying, and on top of that, there's an awful lot of organizations on the right that are doing good criminal justice reform work. I mean, you got Right on Crime. I have a lot of friends who, you know, like for instance, Sean Hopwood at Georgetown, who's doing a lot of really good stuff. You know, he was invited to the Jared Kushner, you know, and Trump thing. You know, I mean, there are plenty of people who are working on both sides. And there are people in the state here in Michigan who are Republicans who are doing the most work on criminal justice reform, even more than the people who are Democrats or progressives. So while I agree with you, and I am a lifelong Democrat, I generally find that at least in local and state politics, that it is an issue you can at least find some common cause. It's going to be hard, you know, there's no doubt about that. But, you know, I mean, we got to start somewhere. And if we don't start standing up, then we're, you know, and all those other issues are really important. They're even really important to me. Some of them are, but none of them affect my life on a daily basis, like the ones that I'm talking about.
And I agree with everything you just said, Josh. I work with any Republican that I can find, because the Republicans, as I've said before, when it comes to crime, they really have the strongest licensure to do the reform, because if a liberal progressive wants to do it, they're accused of turning loose a tidal wave of crime on the citizenry. It's the same thing about national security. You can take a Nixon who can open China and open up relations with improve relations with a communist nation, detente. And if the same comes from the liberal side, they're selling out our national security. You can look at it in foreign relations when you had Yitzhak Rabin in Israel. He was Mr. Security. So he had the licensure to do, the standing to do things to make peace treaties that no other person from the Labor Party would have had. Him and Menachem Begin, if I pronounced it right, were able to do things that the Liberal Party couldn't do. So we do have to get these people on our side. I've just not been successful in my endeavors to try to convert many of them.
Well, our, you know, it's kind of a weird deal, though, because like in Michigan, you know, our legislators overwhelmingly Republican. But the people who have done the most work have, you know, for criminal justice reform of late, you know, you know, Representative Pagel, for instance, or the Speaker of the House, Tom Leonard. You know, there's three things I can point to just off the top of my head, and he's a former prosecutor, you know. So, I mean, it's I think it's really, and you probably know this as much as anyone, it's just getting to know people and finding out which ones are actually the ones that have a friend who was formerly incarcerated or a relative that was formerly incarcerated or know someone on the registry or, you know, I mean, you just have to, you know, and it's not easy. I mean, it's not going to be easy. I don't think, you know, I think you're right. It's an uphill battle, but I meet people every month, you know, that are, you know, on our side, at least at some level.
I agree. And when you look at states where reform is happening, there's a lot of it being led by Republicans. You look at Tennessee, you look at Ohio. They're doing it for probably slightly different reasons, but we don't care about the reasons. We just want the result. We want more people incarcerated. They don't want to spend the money, and they don't want to tax people. They're looking at things to cut. Corrections look like a target that doesn't have as much opposition to cutting as when you start cutting school funding and other things that are more critical. I'm all for getting the conservatives on board, and we have to have them to win this battle. It's just I have not been very good at converting any people in my state, but our people lean that direction. So I wish we could engage our supporters to figure out how to connect with lawmakers and tell their personal stories so we can convert more people. It would be great.
So Larry, I mean, one thing I will say about that is that some of it isn't just telling your stories, in my opinion, and getting, it's also being able to turn out numbers. Like I said right before, one of the biggest problems is that that most legislators, even if they have sympathy with us, don't feel there's a political cost to voting against us. And until the world in which we can show up in numbers, and I mean not just people on the registry, although for instance in Michigan that's 40,000 plus people, and most state elections are decided for less than 40,000 people. But if we could even turn out a portion of that and start, but I'm talking about all criminal justice impacted people, family, friends, allies, started to vote our interests. They would have to start paying attention. Even if they don't seem to pay attention now, that's because it's just a discussion. There's nothing behind it. And what they really care about is getting elected.
Larry, that's exactly what we spoke about. We talked about Pennsylvania, and then if our people went out in force, we forget who was on the ticket, whatever. But we could have swayed the election in Pennsylvania if our people, specifically, whatever it is in Pennsylvania,
Well, I
20,000.
say that again and again and
I
again,
know.
but I run into this that they will disregard all the stuff about criminal justice reform because the other issues, which I consider far less important, if you're being oppressed to the point that you're not allowed to rent an apartment, you're not allowed to hold a job, I can't think of an issue that would be more important than your livelihood if you're living in a tent and just shy of living in a tent when you're living in some crappy place in the Skid Row part of town because that's the only place that would rent to you. I can't believe there would be anything, a border wall. I can't think of anything that would be more important. But for our people, I engaged so many of them. Just a lady last week from Virginia, she went on and on about, yes, I know that I want reform, but I'm going to continue to vote conservative because it reflects my values. And I deal with this all the time. And I said, well, you just told me your values are the opposite. You told me you were for Governor McAuliffe trying to reinstate all the felons who had served their time, and the conservatives filed a lawsuit and stopped it. You just said you were for that, and the conservatives stopped him. How do you square that? Who did you vote for governor? Well, I voted for the Republicans. And I said, this is a lost cause here.
Well, it is a lost cause, but again, one way that I would suggest that that lady or anyone else deal with it is to go into that office with as many other conservative registrants or formerly incarcerated folks or family or friends or allies as she can and say, hey, we all really do want to vote for you. We're for the border wall. We're for this. We're for that. I'm not personally, but I'm just saying if this is their position and that's their values, and we're going to vote for you or we're going to find a candidate that we can vote for. And if enough people keep doing that, then eventually they're going to start listening to the actual agenda because they're going to want those votes. Now, I agree with you that you're not, it might be harder to flip people, although I think it's like you're saying, kind of nuts, because in my opinion, just the idea of being able to, for instance, graduate from the registry would be more important to me than almost any other issue I could think of. Getting rid of a lot of the collateral consequences from incarceration are pretty important. All these things are more salient in my life every day than these kind of things that, yeah, I may have like very, I may have very strong feelings about our policy, say with Iran or North Korea, but that's really probably not going to directly affect me today as much of if I can, if I can get arrested for accidentally being in a restaurant near a school or something.
Agree with you, Josh. We're on the same page. I just I'm probably more burned out and jaded from the years I've been working at this, beating my head against the wall.
We need a new group of people to come behind you because your time's almost up, Larry.
Well, I feel like it's up.
Right. Well, I think that you two could go on and on and on about this all night, but we should probably move along. So the first article comes from NorthJersey.com. Bill Cosby verdict sends strong message to victims, New Jersey experts say. Judge O'Neill allowed for five other accusers to testify as prior bad act witnesses during the retrial, explained Levy. Although prior bad acts are generally not admissible, there are exceptions, he said. None of these prior bad acts were proven in court. That's going to be the issue of the appeal. Larry, I need you to help out with what's going on here.
Well, I haven't seen the appeal. It hasn't been filed yet. So help out on which aspect of it. We talked about 404B, which is the rule regarding prior bad acts extensively.
Well, the article describes that they're going to go for an appeal based on that the people that were testifying, it's just hearsay almost.
Well, it's certainly not hearsay. They're direct witnesses. But the problem is they're a witness in something that, if it occurred at all, it was not on trial. Mr. Cosby was on trial for one victim, not those other five.
That's what I'm getting at, is that they were witnesses of their own case. They weren't witnesses to the victim's case.
404B, the rule of propensity evidence, as it's called, doesn't require that it be in this case. That's how it gets in as the exception to being relevant. It's relevant because it helps prove motive, lack of mistake, a modus operandi. It helps prove. And in this case, clearly, you could say that the testimony from what I was reading was somewhat consistent with what was alleged by the victim who was testifying, the actual victim. And at this point, we don't have to say alleged because Cosby was convicted. Right. So she was, in fact, the victim of his acts.
Well, anyway, the article is talking about that's what the appeal would be based on, is that the women's testimony hadn't been verified.
That will be, I would imagine, if I were involved in the appeal, and these lawyers are going to be, he's going to have the greatest lawyers that would be far above my skill level if I were assisting, but I would be arguing that we would be wanting to know how, these acts, allegations were reported contemporaneously at the time, or if they just surfaced decades later. That would be something I would be arguing, and then I would argue that the judge didn't properly weigh the probative versus prejudicial value. There's supposed to be a very careful balancing of how probative this evidence is in terms of what light it sheds versus the prejudicial value, and the prejudicial effect to the accused. And clearly, it was quite prejudicial to have five people come in and say, "Yep, he did the same kind of thing to me."
Josh, do you have anything?
Yeah, you know, I mean, this gets to the core of something that really bothers me, and I get into these debates on social media a lot, but, you know, one of the things that really upsets me is this notion of either defendant's rights or victim's rights or, you know, perpetrator's rights or whatever you want to call it. They always make it kind of this false dilemma between, you know, even though we've had 30 years of tough on crime, that somehow everything's been tilted toward the perpetrators or supposed alleged perpetrators. And my real problem with this as a, you know, lifelong civil libertarian is that I don't believe we have victims' rights and, you know, defendants' rights. We have constitutional rights, and we all have the same ones. And if the idea of victims' rights, which it seems to ultimately be, is to try to prejudice the trial system to make sure convictions happen, I'm not okay with that. If the idea of victims' rights is to help make sure that people who have been the victims of crime are able to tell their stories, are able to be protected when they're on the stand from, you know, abuse, have time to, you know, take care of themselves or compose themselves or whatever they need to do, I'm 100%, 1,000% on that, as long as the point of it isn't to disrupt the actual trial process in a way that you know, could be prejudicially not beneficial to defendants, because I feel like if the situations were reversed, they'd feel the same way.
Well said, Josh. Unfortunately, the victim's advocacy has made it the illusion that the accused still enjoy all these advantages, and they really don't. But our forefathers intended it to be difficult to convict a person. They intended and deliberately designed a system that would be difficult because they recognized the power of the almighty government.
Well, yeah, supposedly the thing we should hold the tightest to is liberty, and what's at stake is liberty. And, you know, and in a lot of cases, a whole lot of liberty. And so in my opinion, it's very important, yes, it's certainly important to make sure that victims aren't re-traumatized, but that doesn't mean that you have a license to prejudice the trial, in my opinion.
Well, I'm not convinced that a confrontation should be viewed as traumatizing. That's how the system was designed. It was supposed to. That's why there's a confrontation clause in the Constitution. It's sure. not an imagined right. We're supposed to have vigorous confrontation.
Yeah,
your liberty is at stake.
I think we're probably talking about, we're probably dancing around a semantic issue, because I agree with you that the nature of the questions and the ideas behind them should be fair game. Perhaps, there are ways that you could do it that are less, I do think it is relevant that the person, I think even for any of us who have been to prison, we understand that there is such a thing as PTSD, and I understand that the system was designed a certain way, but that people can be triggered or upset in particular ways that sometimes get exploited. All I'm saying is that there should be some care for that, not that the questions aren't relevant or that the person shouldn't be put under the pressure of the questions. We obviously agree on that part.
We do agree on that part. I don't think that when it comes to crimes in general, if you call it abusive to explore if there's a motivation for or accusing a criminality other than it really happened, we don't treat companies when they say they've been embezzled. That's an underreported crime to begin with. But those who do report that, we start investigating their log systems to see how they've kept their records. We start investigating to see if they're in financial trouble, to see if they have any reason to try to manufacture something for insurance purposes. There's nothing wrong with that.
Well, I don't think that the investigation is necessarily what I'm talking about. But I don't think we're, like I said, I think this is probably more about the way questions are asked and the value of, of how people are approached more than it is about the content. I agree with you probably on the content.
Are you saying, Josh, like in the courtroom setting where the defense attorney will be really aggressive and almost condescending and attacking the victim?
Yes.
Okay.
That is what I'm saying.
And
there may be a value to that, but I'm not sure that the value to that is in a lot of cases, I think it's prejudicial in the other way. But that I'm not a lawyer, so I'm probably not the best. This is just my personal feeling. The rest of it, I definitely believe, though, that victims' rights shouldn't prejudice someone's trial. And if it turns out that that is part of prejudicing someone's trial, then, at the same time, I'm just saying I have an empathy toward people who've been victims because, for instance, in my case, I was later in life a perpetrator, but when I was young, I was a victim. So I totally have a lot of empathy for that situation.
And when it's all the discussion is had and complete, at the end of that, a victim is merely a witness in an adversarial proceeding. Nothing more. For the purposes of this proceeding, you are a witness.
Yeah, and we're really just talking about the difference between the legal proceeding and the human being part of it. And I'm kind of talking about the human being part of it, and you're talking about trying to be objective, which I understand.
And this next article is from Criminal Legal News, the Sex Offender Registry, It's Not What You Think. And Sandy, she's a board member of NARSOL, provides a lot of information about the misinformation of what the registry is, including that 40% of those on the registry committed their crimes while they were juveniles for things like mooning or playing doctor. She also presents evidence that 70% of those on the registry would be considered the lowest level risk, followed by 20% for the moderate risk, and 10% would be considered the highest risk. But if we look into what public perception is, anybody on the registry is about to come in your house and abduct all your children and do horrible things to them. That's what the public perception is.
Well, my biggest I actually thought this was a really good article, and I thought she provided a lot of really good information. Kind of one of my biggest pet peeves is when you start from the position of recidivism, or you start with that other position without asking what to me is the most fundamental question, which is why is a registry a good answer to those problems regardless? To me, the fundamental core question that never gets answered in a lot of these debates is why are registries good? I don't think they are. And I don't think there's any evidence that suggests that a public registry is a good idea. I have seen evidence that says that a private registry available only to law enforcement, et cetera, can have a small positive effect on recidivism, but that a public registry creates a much larger chance of recidivism. So to my mind, the core question for me before we even get to this is why registry?
Larry, that has to be music to your ears right there.
It certainly is. The registry, I've not unearthed any evidence that shows it's statistically relevant. But you can't make the argument that absolutely that it doesn't save one. It may have saved one. I don't care if it did or didn't, because we can't flush our Constitution down the crapper to save one. If we did, we could just go ahead and go after the Second Amendment, because I can assure you, depending on how stringent the bans were and what weapons we would disallow, we could save at least one. But we don't save one at the expense of the Constitution. So punishing people after they've done their crime is not within the Constitution of the United States, our American values. We shouldn't be doing it, and I'm against it at all times. And it's just misguided public policy. But the public feels good about the registry. For some reason, despite all this evidence that's out there, if you go out and pull 25 citizens off the street, they will say, yes, I appreciate the registry. It's great, and I have a right to know. Well, no, actually, you don't have a right to know. You have the right to know that a person's been convicted of an offense, but you have no right to know where they're going to school, if they paid the debt to society, what vehicle they're driving, where they live. You have no right to restrict where they can be present. You have no right to restrict who they can engage with or where they can live in a household with someone else. You do not enjoy such rights, nor do you have a right to know. You don't have a right to know the most personal, intimate details about this person's life after they paid the debt to society. That's an imagined right that you think you have that you do not have, and I'm one of the few that'll say that. Most of the sex offenders, when they get interviewed, they'll say, well, yes, they have the right. I guess the public has the right. We need to say, no, actually, they don't.
I find it interesting, too, you brought up something else with the Second Amendment. I frequently say to people who are, you know, advocates of the change of the Second Amendment, et cetera, whatever, I say, isn't it interesting how all the, I really wish is that all the people who are diehard Second Amendment people and who are always talking about how much they do it because they love the Constitution would love it in all instances and for all amendments as much as they do the Second Amendment.
I'm using that as fodder in my legislature. I remind them of that all the time, that you profess to be a big believer in the Constitution. Well, I'm going to ask you to join me. If you say this is worth it, if it saves one, I've already had this dialogue. Okay, I'll join you. I'll be for the registry, and I'll tell my people that I'm for the registry if it saves one. If you'll go out and tell your people, your NRA members, that we're going to have to give up a little bit of these constitutional rights because it's all about saving one child. And I have not gotten a conservative to join me on that yet.
Yeah, I think the framing is a little off. I agree with what you're saying, Larry, but I think the framing might be a little off because it's not a question of if the registry has saved one. It's a question of if the registry has hurt more than it's saved. I understand that you're asking a fundamental question first, which is it constitutional? And I'm definitely on your side with that. But if you're looking at it from a societal safety standpoint, it's not just a question of if the registry has saved one, it's how many people has it hurt, which is why I said a public registry has been shown to increase recidivism, which means it causes more crime than it saves.
Absolutely, Josh, but that's a policy argument about whether it hurts. We have the right to inflict policies and laws that hurt people. We just don't have the right to bulldoze over the Constitution. And ex post facto is an absolute clause in the Constitution. We are not allowed to inflict punishment on people after the fact. That's even more solid than the Second Amendment. Even the right-wing darling, the late Justice Scalia, will tell you that the Second Amendment is not absolute. He said that more than once publicly. I don't know where the limit is on weapons, but I can assure you he said, and I could find it if need be, that there would be a limit. We don't know where. The case would have to.
There is no limit.
There is no limit on ex post facto. You cannot do it, and we're doing it. So I would gravitate toward the Constitution, although that's a very important thing to say it's adverse public policy, but we have the right to have bad public policy. We don't have the right to trample the Constitution.
Although you will admit that that's still an open question, not from our perspective, but from a legal perspective, because as I understand it, the battle that is happening right now is between the circuits that have decided it is ex post facto and the ones that have decided that it's a legitimate safety function of the court.
Well, and that's a function of how poorly the cases were put together, and these challenges have been brought on low budgets or no budgets without the resources to prove, and it's our burden to carry the proof that it is punitive. There's the presumption that it's not, because the legislature intended, when they wrote their preamble, they stated an intent not to be punitive, that this was merely civil regulatory. So the Kennedy-Mendoza seven factors have to be put to test. In the case of Michigan, the panel on the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals concluded it was punitive despite that civil regulatory label. And in many other instances, they're concluding that it's punitive. There would be the case where you could have a registry that isn't punitive. And I tell people that, and I get criticized for that. You could have a very benign registry that would not inflict punishment. It could be private. You could mail in a form once a year. It could have no cost associated with it, and it would have no penalties, no prohibitions in terms of what you could do in your life. And that you could not argue that's punitive. It would be no. constitutional.
There
it would
are
be
elements
regulatory.
Of Minnesota's registry that are similar to that.
And that would be difficult to strike down on constitutional grounds. It would be a policy argument you would have to make. Is this wise use of resources? But most of the registries, I'd say over half of them that I've analyzed, clearly they have so many restrictions. We're about to get involved in a case in Louisiana where the person has to pay nearly $1,000 when they register for community notification. If they live in New Orleans, because of the population density, everyone has to be notified within 2,500 feet, and they have to pay the cost of that within 21 days, or they go to jail if they can't pay it.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
So clearly that's a punitive aspect. They're inflicting punishment through the civil regulatory scheme. It hasn't been challenged because people have been gun-shy. They look at the decisions and they say, well, I'm going to spend a whole bunch of money fighting this, and the registrant has no money to pay me, and I may not win this, and I'm depriving my family of a livelihood while I'm doing this, and I just can't do it.
Well, I think we can find a middle ground, because I think I agree with you, obviously. So I think what we should be saying, maybe in terms of our arguments, is first of all, we don't accept that this is constitutional, and we're not going to accept that it's constitutional, but it also is bad policy.
Absolutely. It's absolutely bad policy.
And I think that we start from a place sometimes farther down the chain, the tree of policy, and we should start at the very beginning when we're talking about policy, that registries just don't work. They're not a good idea.
But Dubling,
and then we can talk about recidivism. But
right, Dubling in Atlanta was saying that you need to get into court on the constitutional grounds, and then you're going to prove it with the ineffectiveness and the recidivism rate. That what's the point? But you're going to get it into court based on it being unconstitutional from the start.
That's correct. You cannot argue how bad or good a policy is as a basis for judicial intervention.
Oh, sure.
It's not for the courts to decide.
Yeah, that's
and
a
I keep
legislative
telling people
function.
That.
It's separation of powers.
If you elect people that run on platforms to do these things, then why are you surprised when they do these things after you elect them?
That's clearly true.
As everybody settles down. This is really awesome, by the way. This is a good conversation. From MainePublic.com, Maine towns allowed to ban sex offenders from parks, fields, a new law allows municipalities to prohibit sex offenders from coming within 750 feet of such property. Officials in Madawaska had argued that the state law only allowed municipalities to ban such individuals who come near property leased to nonprofits. And Larry, I wanted to talk to you specifically about this one in formulating the thoughts around the idea of making a challenge against something like this, without going into the specifics of the statute, but just in concept of where would this start crossing the line of it being legit or not challengeable, or where would it cross the line of being challengeable?
When you say challengeable, you're meaning with any likelihood of success on the merits.
Well, I mean, yeah,
challengeable.
Certainly,
you can follow,
certainly,
you can follow, yeah. You can follow us. The test is going to be the same when this would be similar to the Illinois park ban restriction that they had. Maine just expanded what they felt was lack of clarity in the old statute. This is not a new public policy. It appeared not to apply to publicly owned facilities. So they wanted to make certain that there was no doubt that the 750 feet applied to those facilities where there were public-owned pools or schools or any number of things on the list. Challenging this would be looking at how much there's always new claims you can invent, like taxation without representation that I don't think has been effectively asserted in these claims. But we generally go in saying that it's a punishment, and it's an ex post facto thing because these restrictions apply to people after the fact that they can't do these things, they can't be present in these facilities. But you're going to have to invent some new clever claims. The courts are not buying into to the ex post facto. They're saying this is not punitive enough. There's not enough that the areas of the restrictions are so minor compared to the things that you have access to that they don't find that this to be particularly punitive.
Hey,
So.
Larry, do you think, I mean, two things jump to my mind. The first one is the banishment argument I've seen in a few court cases, and the second one is the idea that it creates a moral hazard for, people to start building more parks.
It does do that. There's actually pocket parks, places where the they can create a pocket park. It just requires a small amount of square footage to have a pocket park, and then they've got a circumference of a radius around that where people can't live or be present. And it's all BS, but they're doing it. In terms of the challenge, I just don't see. I don't see that this is going to be a great challenge. I'm for it if we can fund it, but it made it through the legislature there with, of course, with almost unanimous support. I think it was unanimous, in fact. After they agreed on the language, it was unanimous.
And I'm not so much concerned about that part of it. I was just about the thoughts that people on our side would be having to do the mental gymnastics to just what questions would you start asking? Like you brought up, well, how much area does this then restrict people from living in? If it's only 10% of the pop of the property of the town, then maybe it's not that big a deal. But if it's 90 or 99%, then now you've got effectively
But Andy, I think
banishment,
it's a creep, right? Because if,
right?
like Larry was just talking about, if people start deciding, well, I don't want sex offenders in my neighborhood, and they build a pocket park, then the nature of the amount of territory changes pretty dramatically. Because I'm pretty sure that happened in Los Angeles. I can't remember exactly.
I believe it did, Josh. And the answer to this, fortunately, we're not dealing with it in our state because we don't have the cities and counties. We're not allowed to do anything of this nature. That was done by legislative action rather than court action. Some states, the courts have interceded where the challenge has been that this creates too much confusion. So that is certainly a claim that can be made that these the we have a vagueness, void for vagueness doctrine, which was just in the immigration the permanent resident case we talked about the last week or the episode before. If this is so vague that and it's constantly changing, the people that are subject to enforcement can be held in non-compliance, not knowing what they're supposed to do, how to comply. Maybe there's some challenges that can be asserted. However, the courts haven't been all that generous, but maybe state exemption could be that. But this is a state law. Say we're delegating to the cities the opportunity to do this. So I'm struggling to come up with anything that I think is going to be particularly effective.
Okay. Well, that's kind of what I wanted to try and touch on was even that aspect of are they just like up the creek?
It would have been better if they could have stopped it in the legislature. Unfortunately, we don't have much going on in advocacy in Maine. Maine's not one of the worst states to live in, despite the fact they had those gruesome murders there a decade ago, or however long it was. But the registry in Maine has been tamed by judicial intervention of a decision of a case I can't pronounce. All these things we can't pronounce, but the Maine Supreme Court has limited them in their ex post facto application of the most onerous requirements.
Got it. And then from MissouriNet.com, Missouri Supreme Court hears case on prosecutor who targeted letter writers in sexual assault case. The National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers and the Missouri Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers joined together to submit a friend of the court document in support of the Chief Disciplinary Counsel's proposal to impose sanction on prosecutor Zond, I guess is how you'd pronounce that. You brought this case to the attention of the podcast, Larry, so can you give us some background on it?
Sure, the it's one that really troubles me because I can see a little bit of merit on what the prosecutor's position is. The prosecutor was faced with character letters that were being sent to a small community on behalf of a convicted person of a sexual offense, and the prosecutor let the writers know that they were going to be that, which is already a given. These letters are not private. This is you don't get to make a private letter to the judge about someone you're in support of. Those letters go to both sides. It's an adversarial system. The prosecutor knows exactly who wrote the letter and what was said, but the prosecutor took it a step further. The prosecutor informed the letter writers that their names would be released in a press release advising the public of who they were, various things about them, and that it would be to their interest to consider withdrawing those letters so that they would not have to be on the end of the press release that he was intending to do. And the press release was to the effect of these people support a convicted sex offender.
Hey, Larry, was this pre-sentencing or is this
This
mitigation?
was for mitigation for sentencing.
Yeah, okay.
So the disciplinary council, the lawyers are subject to discipline, and a complaint was alleged that this violated the rules of professional conduct. I don't know all the rules of Missouri. I think that it would be a questionable violation. I don't know exactly what rule number. I didn't read all the stuff about this, but he filed a complaint was filed. Disciplinary counsel found that this violated the rules of professional conduct, and they assessed a $1,000 cost for the action of the investigation and a 6-month suspension of his license for violating the rules of professional conduct, which would mean he would be the elected prosecutor of a jurisdiction which he's not licensed to practice in for 6 months. That discipline has been appealed, and it's before the Missouri Supreme Court. Well, all the law enforcement apparatus is writing, and the victims' advocates are sending their amicus briefs in and urging that the disciplinary board be overturned. And then our side is writing in saying the disciplinary council should be sustained, that he did the right thing, and we're waiting to see what the court does.
This is an issue that is just so crazy to me because the system is already set up in such a prejudicial way pre-sentencing. I don't know if every state has this, but for instance, in Michigan, we have pre-sentencing investigations that are carried out by a parole or probation officer who is barely knows you. And it's given incredible weight by the judges, and even carried through your time if you end up going to prison. It's used even in parole hearings. But mitigation is like, your only hope of maybe mitigating that a little bit. And the idea that you would then try to publicly shame anyone who comes to the assistance or to the side of someone who is, facing sentencing is just, I mean, it's just crazy to me because the system is already so biased at the sentencing phase because of pre-sentencing investigations against the defendant.
You're absolutely right, Josh, and that's the struggle on this because the probation officers, I've read since I work in the business, I've read a number of pre-sentence reports in my career. They don't often emphasize the positive achievements of the person, although they occasionally do. They occasionally do, but usually they emphasize the person at their worst.
Sure, and
And
they're on the team of law enforcement. I mean, they're not. I mean, even if they miracles happen, and I got two reports, and one of them was okay, even if miracles happen, the odds are pretty good that they're going to be taking the side of the law enforcement end of things. In my opinion.
And these reports generally limit the positive. A person who's standing before a judge for sentencing has lived a life anywhere from a couple of decades to 50, five, six, seven, 8 decades. And these people that are writing are saying this person has been a stellar asset to the community for decades, and take that into consideration. And that component will, if the state wins this, if the Supreme Court rules in favor of the prosecution, that will further diminish people writing in on behalf of the convicted person, trying to give a more balanced view of their life, which will further prejudice and tip the scales in favor of harsh sentencing because the judges won't know about good things that people have done. It
Yeah,
will restrict their access to information.
I think this is another example of what we were talking about before, of how at least an aspect of what's called victims' rights ends up being really an attempt to prejudice the process even more, in my opinion.
Well, but the prosecutor has valid arguments. He has the right to issue a press release, does he not? Well, of course, everybody would say he does have that right to issue a press statement, but he's elected by the people in that jurisdiction. He's their spokesperson. He has the right to communicate with them. Does he have the right to try to intimidate people who would provide the court balance from speaking? That's going to be the question. Does he have the right? Is this an attempt to intimidate and silence? And if so, does he enjoy that right?
I'm going to go ahead and say no.
Are you just being disagreeable?
Well, no, I don't want prosecutors to be able to intimidate people who are trying to mitigate.
And
I don't have a legal basis for that, but.
neither did the disciplinary council in Missouri, to their credit. And I hope that the Supreme Court upholds the disciplinary council and finds that they should, that was over the top. But we will wait and see.
It seems like he has. It's legit for him to issue the press release, but he was releasing the people's work addresses and prior work addresses, or at least work names, totally shaming the people. It seems like it would have been legit to maybe shame an organization for doing it, or like a first initial last name or something like that, just to semi shed some light on the people doing it. But he like totally called them out, almost like the sex offender
Well,
registry.
let's flip it. Let's flip it over. What would happen if the what's not allowed by the rules of the limits of what are placed on what a victim in most states? I know Norm Pattis got a lot of praise for an acquittal he just got a couple of weeks ago in the last month for he's a Connecticut attorney for some very aggressive cross-examination, which is forbidden in most jurisdictions. What would happen if you flipped it over? And all the stuff that the defense wanted to get in about the accuser, how they had conducted themselves, what if they issued a press release and condemned and outed all the bad things that that person had done? I wonder if we would be having this discussion right now.
I don't.
I wonder if the prosecution would be in favor of a defense attorney having the right to do that.
I would be willing to bet that the prosecutor would not like that.
I would be willing to bet that not only the prosecutor wouldn't like it, the victim's advocates would cry, holy hell.
Of course.
But they don't see this because this is the other side. The accused should never be humanized.
Right.
But if we did the same thing, they would be screaming murder.
Yeah, that justice will never be served, etc.
Sigh.
It makes me think about in, I think it's France, you can't even do a perp walk. You can't even have all the cameras running around as the person's taken out of the car as they're taken downtown or whatever, just to prevent there from being that media bias and taking all the pictures and showing the person as being guilty before they've even been really formally accused of anything.
And that's the intent of the perp walk.
Of course.
Like, to say it's not prejudicial is insane because that's the whole point.
Right. All right. God, you guys aren't making me feel any happier tonight. All right. Well, so this next one comes from the PBS NewsHour, and I even have some audio clips. Missouri public defenders are overloaded with hundreds of cases while defendants wait in jail. The Sixth Amendment to the Constitution guarantees every American facing trial the right to a lawyer, even if they cannot afford one. But across the country, public defender systems is being stretched to the breaking point, and Missouri may be ground zero.
First, when someone is charged with a crime but cannot afford an attorney, the court is required to provide one. In most cases, that person is a so-called public defender. But what if that public defender already has too many clients to serve as competent representation? That's a situation playing out in many states, including Missouri, where public defenders have started refusing cases, throwing a wrench into the machinery of the criminal justice system.
I realize there's a limit to how much a person can work, but how do you, as a public defender, go, eh, I can't do your case?
Well, you have to remember, I think, Andy, and we did a whole episode on indigent defense and public defenders on Decarceration Nation. But I think you have to remember that, here's a great example. When I was in, I was just hanging out and, you know, waiting for my, I can't even remember which hearing it was when I was awaiting, you know, when I was in the adjudication process. And I went over and just started looking at the docket, and there were public defenders who were hearing 30 cases a day. You know, I mean, how much of a quality defense are you raising for your clients when you probably barely know their names? So, I mean, I have some sympathy for the public defenders. And part of this is because, you know, there's no equivalency between the prosecutor's budget, the prosecutor's office budget, and the public defense budget in most states. And obviously the prosecutor has a much larger budget, a lot more resources, and they have a free investigation service known as the police. And so, you know, I mean, something's got to give, you know, I mean, it sucks.
Larry?
Well, the public defenders generally cannot refuse to take cases because they are charged under the statute. If it's a state public defender system or if it's an appointed system, they're obligated to take the appointments. But what you can do, and I advise that, and they look at me like I've beamed in from Mars, but in Missouri, the public defender subpoenaed the governor to appointed him to a case, not subpoenaed, but appointed him to a case. But what you can do is when the judge calls for the case, you can, when a judge says, counselors, are you ready? You say, no, sir, I am not. And when a judge says, why aren't you ready? Because I've got 72 cases and I haven't been able to get to this case. So no, Your Honor, I'm not ready. And then if the judge says, well, we got a trial setting for 2 weeks from now, you're going to be ready. You say, Your Honor, yes, I'm going to be as ready as I can. I'm going to try my best. And when you come in, the judge says, are you ready? You do the same thing. You say, no, Your Honor, not ready. I'm not ready. And if you're forced to go to trial, then you state for the record, Your Honor, I object that we're moving forward with this case because I cannot render effective representation. I have not had the opportunity to go through all the discovery. I've had pretrial interviews I should have done that I haven't done. I haven't had the budget to hire an expert to look at some forensics evidence that the state has provided. So I want to lay the record that the court is requiring me to go, and I'm not prepared, and I cannot provide constitutionally effective representation. That's what you can do. Now, there may be a consequence to doing that. If you're on a contract basis, you may find that they don't refer you to more contract work, and it may have an effect on your livelihood. And if you work for a public defender system where you're on the payroll, the chief public defender is probably going to get called in, and he's going to get reamed out to why that person is establishing the record. And the chief public defender needs to say, well, Your Honor, he's doing that because that's what I instructed him to do. I instructed all my associate defenders to let the courts know that they cannot properly represent these people, and we're going to establish a record as long as it takes until we get adequate resources to defend people in a constitutional, effective manner. That's what you can do.
Well, and you can also, as from a policy perspective, peg the public defender's office resources at the, you know, at a level that's similar to the prosecutor's. I think I've seen different proposals up to 80%.
But you could do that, but you've got to go through a political process where there's no public support for that.
But meanwhile, the person that's accused is just sitting in the tank.
That is an unfortunate, very unfortunate, tragic collateral consequence. Then we have to come together and figure out ways to file creative motions to get people that are in detention who have not had adequate representation, some mechanism to try to provide them relief.
Well, and this is also part of why so many people plea. It's not just that you're put in the shotgun situation, but it's also that there's a huge incentive for the public defender to plea because they don't have time to do much more than that.
And I have a clip that covers that. Let's move on.
You have to go visit with your client. You have to look at the charges that your client faces. You have to investigate the case. You have to meet with witnesses. You have to talk to the police officer. You have to file motions. You have to receive the evidence that the prosecution has and then discuss the evidence with your client. To think that you can do each one of those steps in 150 cases is absolutely ridiculous.
I just want to, I know that we've said similar things. Larry, you've specifically said things like that. And Josh, I heard the episode you were talking about for the indigent defense. So here is Michael Barrett is the head of Missouri Public Defender System. And that's a quote from him speaking to that point exactly.
Well, how could you possibly, if you're doing 150 felony level cases and there's 250 working days in a year, how could you possibly do all those things for your clients effectively, because you would be having to plead out a case practically every day?
That's what it sounds like.
And the plea itself takes time because you have to go through the ritual of establishing all the things that have to be established for the bona fide acceptance of a plea. But it's the 150 cases are not humanly possible. I got a letter from somebody in an Oregon prison saying that public defenders typically handle 1,000 felony cases a year, and I felt like it was so ridiculous. But I did respond to it, say, that's not humanly possible to do 1,000 felony level cases in a year.
Well, come on, man. You know the public defenders, being an attorney, they should just be working for free because the work's so easy.
Well, even if it were free, you could not do 1,000. That would be 4 pleas a day. You can't do four guilty pleas a day. Because as you heard Mr. Barrett, he explained the processes. If you go through all that stuff before you decide that a plea is in order, that itself takes more than a half a day. The answer is that the citizens are going to have to be willing to fund, or the courts are going to have to be willing to start turning people loose. Like in the California prisons when they got grossly overcrowded, the federal judge says, well, I can't make you people build prisons. That's your prerogative. But what I can do is tell you that there's a limit to how many people you can put in these. And the judges and the courts are going to have to say, we can't make you fund the public defender's office, but what we can do is we can dismiss cases where the time limits are not being met.
And that's what we were seeing up in Philadelphia.
Oh, the Philadelphia prosecutor's office?
Yes.
That's where you got a friendly prosecutor that's trying to cut the caseload, but we don't have that very often around the country where the prosecutor's trying to work for a lower caseload.
Well, I think that's part of the reason why, a lot of people have suggested that one of the things that we really need to do, and the first time I heard someone talk about it was Danielle Sered from the Vera Institute, is that, we should change or find a way to change the incentive structure for prosecutors' offices. And I think that's what Larry Krasner is doing a pretty good job of. And, moving from things like how many convictions you get to the actual outcomes you get. Actual, like, what happens to the people outcomes. And I've always thought that outcome-based criminal justice reform is much better than what we've got now as a general rule.
I agree with you, Josh. Unfortunately, the citizens are not willing to elect prosecutors like him. That's not what sells to most voters. And we elect prosecutors in almost all of our jurisdictions around the country at the state level.
There are some pretty good new organizations that are coming up that are doing a lot of work to try to agitate to get progressive, or what you would call progressive, prosecutors elected. We'll have to see in this cycle how they do. But, like Sean King's organization, then a Rory, forgetting his last name, but there's, I think it's called Foglight LLC. But both of those people are doing a lot of work trying to get more progressive prosecutors elected.
And a lot of them run pretending to be progressive, and they magically fall into that law enforcement mentality the day they assume office. We did the same thing here. We thought we were elected a progressive here with Raul Torres. He's turned out to be no different than the previous administration, and in some aspects even worse. And that happens across the country. They're progressive until they get in office, and then all of a sudden their perspective goes right in along with the law enforcement apparatus, the prison industrial complex.
Well, it definitely doesn't help that, they have so much interaction with law enforcement, and they have so much of an incentive to work to fall into that camp. Yeah.
As a result, defendants like Rashad Ashton often end up pleading guilty to crimes they say they didn't commit just to get out of jail. It's called pleading to daylight.
And you just spoke about that, Josh.
Well, I think the obvious example of that is the case in Rikers, Kalief Browder, who he didn't end up pleading out, and it ended up being pretty devastating for him. But he talked a lot about how much he wanted to plead to daylight, and there's a lot of people who've said that they did plead to daylight, that, jails, I know from my own experience that jails, as bad as prisons are, jails are much worse in a lot of cases. And there's just on the present threat, like the jail that I was at since, I think it's 2012, there's been 18 deaths. And that's a lot, and that's not even counting all the violence and everything else that's happened. It's just the deaths. And so, yeah, there's a lot of incentive when you can't afford bail and you're stuck in jail, to try to plea out, because in a lot of cases, and if you watch any of the Rikers documentaries or any of the, you'll hear the reasons why people want to get the heck out of the jail as soon as humanly possible.
And then finally,
David Wiegert has been a public defender in Jackson County for 6 years.
I thought that this whole thing is a ticking time bomb for all of us. It is probably due to our clients' inexperience with the system that they don't know how to file proper bar complaints against us. That allows us to keep going with the system in which we don't give them proper service. But if they were ever made aware of the ways in which they can file formal ethical complaints against us, I think that the gates are open at that point, and I think we drop like flies.
I thought you could speak to that, Larry.
Well, that's kind of what I was addressing earlier, that the prosecutors, the public defenders need to go ahead, since they know, he just admitted the obvious, that the clients do not know these rules. They need to go ahead and lay the record for them, so that when they look down the road and they get in jail and they start talking to a jailhouse lawyer, there's already the record laid for them that this representation was ineffective. Don't wish that the clients were smart, sir. Go ahead and do it yourself. Speak up now and lay the record that your representation has been constitutionally inadequate. And then when they file their habeas corpus, you immediately stipulate that your representation, to the best of your ability, was totally inadequate, and you stipulate to why, and you let the person put that in the habeas petition. If you really want to help them, quit making excuses and do the help. I'm telling you how to do it. Here's the roadmap to how you get there.
Hmm. Josh?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I agree that that sounds like what you should. It's really frustrating that it seems like if there's really a flaw in the democratic system, it's this, for whatever reason, this your career becoming entire, you know, your ethics becomes secondary to your career. And so, I mean, with legislators, all that matters is getting elected. With prosecutors, all that matters is getting elected. Even with these terrible public defender jobs, all that matters is getting more cases, even at the expense of the, you know, for a fact, if you're one of those public defenders, and I know a lot of them are working really hard and it's a tough job, but you know, for a fact, a lot of times you're not providing a robust defense, but you just let the system just eat it up, just keep eating everybody up. You know, it's just, it's depressing.
Well, I can't guarantee there won't be consequences. I can't guarantee you that, but I can guarantee you this. The system won't change without you doing some of the things I'm recommending. You're the one that's in the driver's seat here to establish the record. The defendant doesn't get to speak. You're his or her mouthpiece. Use your mouth where they are silenced, and you establish the record that's going to show that you're not doing a constitutionally effective job. Don't pass the buck. Do it. It's the right thing to do.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible. From the Miami Herald, homeless sex offenders are getting kicked out of their South Florida encampment. Now what? This is a place in Florida where, due to other restrictions, 2,000 feet, 2,500 in Florida. I forget what the limit is there, where they have just been pushed off into almost like a warehouse district. And there's a tent city there. And they came in and said, you guys got to go. And where are they supposed to go then?
Yeah, I remember the first time I heard about this tent city or under the bridge city, actually when I was incarcerated. I was really lucky that I had a friend that sent me the New York Times. I know that's crazy. I was probably the only person in the history of prison who got a daily New York Times, but I did. And I remember, I guess it had to have been somewhere around 2013 or 2014, reading this the first time and just being so disturbed. You know, I don't know what it's going to be like when I get out, and I'm reading about Florida and about how there's places where there's nowhere for anyone to live. So they have to literally live under a bridge. And then, you know, a little bit after that, let's forward, you know, I finally get through parole and probation, and I go to my first NARSOL conference, and we watch the Untouchable documentary by David Feig. And, you know, I'm just watching this thing and I'm going, you know, I mean, I sure am glad I live in Michigan is, I guess, all I would say. I mean, right. It's just awful. And one of the things I was thinking when I heard this story this time when I heard it the first time, I was just thinking to myself, you know how crazy the sex offender registry is when I'm sitting here rooting for a bunch of people to be able to stay living under a bridge.
Right, right. It's miserable. And I can't for the life of me figure out it's like, hey, we're going to institute this thing without anybody looking, not forget like 10 moves out, but even just like the next one. Well, if they can't live here, where are they going to live? Nobody even quit. Like, where are they going to go? Oh, they're going to pitch a tent next to an abandoned semi trailer.
I think that's mostly because the person who's writing all these rules could care less what they do. I mean, obviously, for those of you who don't, I mean, this was another of the many wonderful ideas by the books in Florida, which, you know, the older book, The Gentleman, is one of the biggest political powers in Florida. He's a lobbyist and has been for a long time. I think he was really got his power under the Clinton because he had relationships with the Clinton family or something like that, if I remember correctly. And, you know, basically his daughter was there was some kind of sexual abuse with a maid. And as a result of that, for the last at least, you know, I don't know, 10, 15 years, I don't know, they've been basically coming up with a million ways to push new laws that increase the level of restriction on sex offenders. And so, you know, Florida has some, I mean, especially that area of Florida has some of the craziest, I mean, everything you can imagine, you know, I mean, I'm sure the people who are listening who are from Florida are well aware, but man, it's just, I mean, it's like they've created an industry around every year having a new set of restrictions to put on sex offenders.
Again, I'm just baffled at thinking about what are they supposed to do next. If, I mean, they have to live somewhere. To me, then the alternative question is, okay, you don't want them here, you don't want them anywhere. You should have sentenced them to life and or you should have sentenced them to the death penalty.
Well, I kind of remember when I lived in New York City, it was a different New York City that exists now. And that's because at one point in New York City, one of the mayors decided that it would be a good idea to take all the undesirable elements and make it so hard for them to live there that they had to move to a different state. And ultimately that happened. You know, and so the New York of today, while I'm not saying it's perfect, is much different than New York of my youth. And frankly, I like the old New York better. But you know, I feel like maybe that's maybe what his, you know, I don't know what his goal really is aside from continuing to use this to amass political power for his daughter, but who's now in the legislature, if I right. remember correctly.
She is.
Yeah. And so this, you know, the keeping this thing going, it's like I said, it's like a family business for them. And I kind of feel like if there is, I don't think they care at all what happens, but my guess is they would say, well, they'd rather they just moved out of Florida, but I could be wrong. I don't know.
But that's not necessarily easy. You can't just pick up and move unless you have a reason to get to that next state. You just, it's not that easy to do.
I'm saying that I don't think they care about the practicality. I'm saying they could care less because it's not about, all it's about to them is the continuing to have the issue. I think, I don't, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think they could. I think they could care less if someone has no alternative and they end up back in prison. They don't care if they move. They don't care. They just want to keep ramping it up because it keeps them in the spotlight.
Right. And so then I guess a follow-up came out just maybe in the last day or so that maybe they're going to be allowed to stay.
Yeah, that's my understanding. Is there some kind of a delay or a stay? I didn't get a lot of time to read that, but that was good news. I thought, like I said, it's a little weird to be rooting for people to get to keep living under a bridge, but as opposed to having no alternatives, that's definitely better.
It's ridiculous.
Josh, I kind of sidestepped your question about banishment earlier because I was going to bash about banishment on this article, and I didn't want to do it twice. So. we were talking about the park segment in Maine. I kind of sidestepped you on banishment. Banishment is a tough. There's a conservative view of banishment, And then there's the more progressive view of banishment. The conservative view of banishment is we look at the words as they were meant and were meant and understood at the time the Constitution was framed in colonial times. And banishment had the meaning of pushing someone out altogether. That's why the residency restrictions have been difficult to prevail on banishment, because they're free to usually be in the city. They just can't live there. And that's not a true banishment, as far as a conservative jurist would tell you, that I have to look at what the framers would have meant at that time. All this evolving standards of decency is nothing but bullshit. Here's an opportunity for us to give the conservatives something to hang their hat on in the court system. We can map out this. It's going to cost some money, but a legal challenge could be mounted in Dade County and Broward and those heavily populated counties in South Florida. I believe Broward's next to Dade, but I know Dade is Miami. We could do a challenge there, and we could map out that only a minuscule percentage of the land parcels are available, which you effectively do have a banishment. I think a banishment claim would work here because they're not allowed to live there, and they're not allowed to be there because of the proximity restrictions, if I understand Florida restrictions correctly, which gets us much closer to a banishment. And we can hand this to the conservatives on the court and say, hey, does this meet your narrow standard of banishment? They can't live there. They can't be present there. And they've got 0.33%, which is probably more than that, but they've got 9.2% of the landmass in Dade County available to them. Does this qualify? And see what they say.
Sounds like a good idea to me.
I'd love to see the banishment argument asserted in cases where both they can't live anywhere and they can't be in town because of the loitering and the anti-presence restrictions. You combine that, you can almost meet the tough definition of banishment.
Isn't that what was going on in North Carolina? That's what Dubling said in his presentation about the, I'm pretty sure they had presence restrictions where you couldn't even get to like the state, the capital.
Yes, they're not quite as bad as Florida because they don't have the stringent residence restrictions at Dade County, because Florida has a state restriction and then they have their locals that exceed that. And of course, I would want to go after the preemption and the challenge as well, and say that the state needs a uniform regulatory system. Therefore, the locals can't do that. But that's an inconsistent argument, because some people like for the cities to be able to regulate things if they agree with them, and then they magically don't like the cities to be able to regulate things that they don't agree with. And I'll give you an example, like minimum wage. Conservatives who claim that they believe so strongly in local home rule and that the people that are closer to the community, closer to the voters, are the wisest, therefore they should be empowered more, that they're the smartest. They have preempted every chance they get where they're the majority at the state level. Any local minimum wage in Missouri, for example, St. Louis voters have voted a higher minimum wage, and they just went into session and said, oh, gee, well, we're smarter here. We preempt them because we don't agree with that. Well, we can't have it both ways. We either believe that there should – I'm a minimum wage believer that I think the minimum wage should be higher. Therefore, I'm kind of okay with locals setting a higher minimum wage. But then I turn around and say, well, we shouldn't allow the locals – which way is it? You can't be intellectually honest if you are on both sides of that issue. I'm intellectually honest enough to admit to you that I'm not intellectually honest on that issue. But most people will do a flip-flop and twist themselves into a pretzel. but the locals should not be having all these hopscotch of regulations, because that makes it, even if they're smarter and more brilliant, it makes it almost impossible for people to comply with. How many municipality governments are in the state of Florida? Any idea?
No.
If they all have all these different regulations, how are you supposed to know how to comply?
Right.
When you're egressing, transgression, when you're crossing them, I mean, if you're going to be there for a day or two, there's no way possible you could comply with all this stuff and have a map and all that at your disposal.
Well, and just even knowing how to comply, I mean, that's, I think, one of the real frustrations for all of us who are caught up in this stuff is the knowing how to comply. I mean, you know, in the Doe's case, one of the famous moments in the Doe's case was that Tim, who was working with the ACLU, called all the state police offices throughout the state and asked them the same set of questions about compliance, and they got a different set of answers every single time. So even the people who are enforcing it will enforce it differently in different jurisdictions, and that's got to be true in terms of all these different localities and the way that everything interacts. It's just a total mess. Man, there's just no way to be. I mean, a lot of times, like when I give talks to people about compliance, which I do sometimes, I always preface the talks, Michigan's compliance. I always preface the talks by saying, look, this is, a lot of this is my best guess based on what I found in court decisions and whatever people have said at the highest level. But the truth is nobody really knows. You know, I mean, we know what the words are, but we don't necessarily know what the interpretation, the correct legal interpretation of a lot of them is.
And I'm glad to hear you say that, because people get frustrated with me when I tell them sometimes we don't know because it's a matter that hasn't been interpreted and the words were not succinctly and clearly written. And therefore, we can only guess what they might have meant. And depending on what side of the perspective and issue you're on, you could have two completely rational discussions about the words mean this or they mean that.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's all speculation until a court decides it. So.
Well, I hope to see some challenges in Florida, some real effective challenges. We've got an active affiliate, the NARSL organization does, and I'm hoping that they're working on challenges. They don't run all their strategy past us, so I don't know precisely what they're doing, but I hope that there's some things coming down.
Well, I doubt any of them can, you know, I don't know what kind of, you know, how you can listen to podcasts under the bridge, but if you can, I hope those people know that a lot of people are thinking about them.
We got to get the word out, Josh. We need more people to listen to podcasts.
Yeah, that too.
See, these old people that are hanging around, their time is, you know, running out and they need to move on, perhaps, Larry. And, you know, then we can get some younger people that listen to podcasts.
Yeah. Right. I know Larry must listen to every one of y'all's podcasts and mine.
I can't barely stand to listen at myself doing this. Listen to myself a second time is more than I can take. So I'm just amazed that people listen to the numbers if they're listening. And I'm just kidding. I hope we're providing valuable information and we're helping people and encouraging people to know that we're doing all we can with the resources that we have. Resources are constantly the issue. And you see our restraint is largely because of resources, not because of will.
Well, and I say this to people all the time. I think I was just talking about this earlier today. Is, you know, and when we were talking about bars to ballots at the very beginning, maybe this is a full circle kind of thing, but I say this all the time that, my podcast, you know, it's totally do it yourself. I bought I have a microphone, I have a laptop computer. I figured out I didn't even know how to do any of it. And, you know, I do it, you know, you can do anything I do, you can do, you know, I mean, you're right that resources matter. But, you know, I'm pretty much a self-contained. I put out all the promotion myself. I do everything else. And, you know, it's just a passion project for me. And, you know, I mean, you know, whether it be voting or going to meet legislators, like for me, it was symbolically really important to be a delegate to the Democratic nominating convention this year in Michigan, because I'm publicly a criminal justice reform advocate, a formerly incarcerated person, and a registered citizen. And I let everybody know that. And so, you know, I keep showing this picture of me holding a lanyard at the thing in front of the big stage, because not because I think, you know, I know I'm not pretty, but the idea is just to say, hey, if I can do this, you can do this, you know, and I feel that's true with all this stuff, podcasts or writing stories online. I know a lot of people who do that kind of stuff, sharing information, you know, going to the conferences, networking, whatever it is, if we can do it, you can do it.
I agree wholeheartedly, because, you know, this was all put together. It's just funded out of my own pocket, and Larry donates his time, basically. That's how our podcast works, just the same.
Yep.
And our final article is from Appellate Squawk. Come on, Larry, this is all you. The Court of Appeals believes the victim, even when the jury doesn't. In a 6-1 opinion, with only the redoubtable Judge Rivera dissenting, the court upheld the lower court's decision putting the defendant on the Internet Sex Offender Registry for the rest of his life based on acquitted charges. So if I get this right, the person was tried and then the charges rescinded. He was acquitted, but still ends up on the registry?
I took the time to do some research on the case, and this is an example of less than thorough journalism. Because the journalist didn't bother to actually report the entire case accurately. He was acquitted of almost all the charges, but he was convicted of one count.
And I'm guessing that one count was a sexual offense of some sort.
It was a sexual offense.
That would make a big difference.
And so he ended up as a convicted person, having gone to trial and had a not guilty verdict on. The jury was hung sent the judge notes three times that they were hung, and then they managed to unhang themselves, and found him not guilty of all the counts except one, and so he was convicted of a sexual offense, which in this state of New York they have a risk-based system, and at that process it's not offense-based, it's risk-based. So he had an opportunity to cooperate with the risk assessment. But to do so, it was placed him in peril, because if you can imagine, you're contemplating appealing the one conviction that you did have. But in order to be risk assessed, you have to talk about what you were convicted of. Which means that Mr. Quinn, the guy's name, Mr. Quinn Britton, was I don't know if it's Britton Quinn the way, but anyway, this individual was asked to cooperate with his assessment so that they could properly level him. And he declined to do so. And I hate to say so, but he did decline to participate in the process. And that was his right to invoke his Fifth Amendment. But in doing so, that caused extra points to accrue to him for that. He was given extra points. And then the standard for putting a person for their risk level is not subject to the same evidentiary rules as a criminal proceeding, and the evidentiary standard is slightly lower. It's that the state has to prove it by clear and convincing evidence that the offense occurred. And it's not the same as beyond a reasonable doubt. It's the next most stringent standard, but it's not beyond a reasonable doubt, which left the court the prerogative to find that there was an evidence level high enough. The judge had sat through the trial to say, I believe the accuser. The jury chose not to, but I believe the accuser, and I find that there's clear and convincing evidence based on the fact that he gave a pretrial interview to the detective. The detective alleged that he admitted the stuff that he took the stand and said he didn't do it, but unfortunately the detective didn't record it, which means the detective could have been lying or he could have been telling the truth. And I'm not going to opine which way it was, but the detective didn't have anything other than he said that the person admitted to the offenses. But the jury didn't believe that was beyond a reasonable doubt without any stronger evidence. So the jury didn't convict him. But the judge found that there was a lesser evidentiary standard to find that he did commit the acquitted charges, which means that combined with the extra points made him a higher level offender than he would have been. Potentially, and the lowest level offenders don't get displayed to the public. And I'm not sure if the level two put him on the public registry, but I think it does. I'm not an expert on New York registry.
Can you back up just one step? The jury acquitted him on all charges, but the judge then still found him guilty on one charge?
No, the jury convicted him of one sex charge.
Okay.
And acquitted him of the others.
All right.
Him in the position of needing to be risk evaluated because he's a convicted sex offender at that point.
Right.
And this is one of the, I mean, this isn't exactly, this case doesn't do this, but one thing that I think, you know, I think we need to be aware of and talk about is that while in general, for I think in the main, risk-based systems are probably better for most people than a offense-based system. For some people, it can be worse. And for some people, it can be a lot worse. And so, you know, I mean, you know, I know everyone doesn't agree with me on this, but that's why I'm such a big fan of the notion of graduation, because there's so much research that suggests after a certain amount of time, be it 7, 10, 12 years, depending on the different research you talk about, that people's level of supposed risk drops below the risk in the general population. And also things like that people age out of crime, a lot of other things that, in my opinion, the for me at least, one of the gold standards is the idea that people, until we can get to the idea where everyone agrees that the registry itself isn't a good idea, that maybe another, or we get a constitutional challenge that overturns it, one thing I would really like to see is graduation built into registries, that if you remain offense free, that regardless of your tier, you have a chance to graduate automatically in a clean slate kind of manner.
I agree with you, Josh. Well said. Can I read the sentence from the opinion so that people understand? The jury acquitted defendant of first-degree rape, and they cite the code of New York statute, and two counts of criminal sexual act in the first degree, and they cite the statute. All of those were felony charges, and convicted of one count of second degree sexual abuse, which was a misdemeanor. That brought him into the ambit of registration.
Got it. So I just want to clarify, are you saying that he got convicted of a misdemeanor and somehow that's become lifetime registration?
Uh-huh.
He got convicted of the misdemeanor, but under New York's risk-based system, it's not an offense-based system. Now, magically, people would like the offense-based system better here. But a risk-based system takes into account your actual sexual behavior and the factors. So the jury did not find that they had enough evidence beyond a reasonable doubt.
No, I got you.
But the judge felt that since he doesn't have that standard for assigning the making the risk determination, it's only by clear and convincing evidence. He found that the clear and convincing evidence existed that those crimes were committed that the jury didn't convict on. Therefore, he assigned that extra level based on his finding that there was evidence of a clear and convincing nature.
Yeah, that's why I think I might have suggested earlier that, you know, that's about as badly as a risk-based system can go for someone is what I'm suggesting.
Certainly. Well, everybody thinks the risk-based system is somehow magically without any imperfections, especially the non-contact offenders. They think that magically they'll be low risk. And of course, if they got to looking at the states where they have risk-based systems, they'll find out that the non-contact offenders typically are much higher risk. But in this case, the judge was permitted to consider whether there was evidence of other sexual deviancy. He considered it and he found it to be clear and convincing, and he assigned those points, and he ends up at a higher risk level. Mm. We like judicial discretion until such time as we don't like how the discretion comes down, kind of like the Judge Persky with the Stanford swimmer when he imposed the very short incarceration followed by probation. You remember the case where
there's a, you know, luckily there are a lot of people who have defended that judge quite a bit of late. So.
Yeah, but the voters are going to turn him out regardless of what happened. The voters are going to turn him out with an overwhelming margin. But our people, it frustrates me that our people, we claim that we want judicial discretion and we want judges. We prefer judges who exercise some independence. That judge did that very thing. And some of our people have been the most upset about, well, my son got it. Well, but your son was not in the same situation where the probation department recommended this type of sentence.
Well, I'd like to suggest that one thing we should stop doing as a group generally, not, I don't mean NARSOL, I mean us as offenders, sex offenders or whatever you want to call, the registered citizens is probably the better nomenclature. But what we should do is stop saying this registry would be okay. I mean, I think we should start with the premise that the registry is not okay and then try to make the best of what's left, but never giving ground on the notion that the registry itself is a bad idea.
I agree with you, Josh. I oppose the registry, period, end of discussion. If you're going to do a registry, you have to do it within the constitutional confines, which would be a very benign registry process, which virtually doesn't exist anywhere in the United States except for a couple of states that I could say probably meet that benign test.
Yeah.
But even that I don't support because it still doesn't serve any purpose, but you could do it from a constitutional perspective. You could do things that are bad public policy.
As long as you're operating
within the Constitution.
We do all the time, unfortunately.
Absolutely. And we get mad when the judges don't save us from bad choices we make.
To circle back around,
call it legislating from the bench when they strike something down that we agree with. We're quite a mess of hypocrisy.
Right.
Yes, we are.
And to circle back around, though, you mentioned some studies, Josh, that talked about people aging out of crimes, where I'm sure you saw the debate with Marcy Hamilton and Emily Horowitz, and she said they absolutely somehow magically when you turn 18, treatment is over. It's a non-issue. But Emily turns around and she cites meta studies. But, you know, I have read certain studies that even after like 3 years, your law enforcement officer has a higher chance statistically of being an offender than you do as a former or as a registrant to reoffend. But Marcy,
I don't know if I really want to comment on that.
Well, but I mean, no,
I was just joking because of the law enforcement.
Yeah, well, screw that. But Marcy Hamilton is out there beating a really, really loud drum saying that there is no rehabilitation for over 18.
Well,
there's the statute of limitations should be opened up forever.
one of the biggest problems we have, and this is, goes back to, like you said, full circle, is that we are not, and it's understandable. I mean, we get beaten down by everybody.
Yep.
We get abused when we put our heads up. Like when I was talking about earlier about, you know, showing the lanyard and all that. I mean, I understand that, you know, I've been, you know, people have come after me in every possible way, you know, and I'm, that happens for everybody, and there's dangers and stuff. And, you know, people have wished death on me and all kinds of stuff like that. It's not like it, I understand why people don't do it, but if we don't stand up and we don't talk about these things and we don't, for instance, call out Marcy Hamilton, you know, most of the research that she uses is at best questionable. And the evidence she uses the most, these kind of really bad studies done in a limited setting, usually with college students asking kind of just questions and stuff like that, are not relevant to our situation almost ever, and usually don't have any sample size that justifies her conclusions. Now, that sounds dry when we're talking about it here, but, you know, I thought that Emily did an amazing job of beating her up on that. I mean, yes. You took a crowd that at the beginning of that event were solidly on the side of registries being good, and they flipped by the end of the debate, which is astounding given how much people love the registry as a general rule. So that actually gave me a lot of hope seeing that debate.
I didn't do the comment section where we had, I had a huge long thread with somebody from New York who wished to remain anonymous, but I did want to throw a shout out there to someone out there in New York. You know who you are, and that we appreciate very much that you're listening to the show, and hope that you'll enjoy this one. This one has run very, very, very long, and I appreciate everyone's patience in sticking with us if you've made it this far. I deeply, deeply, deeply want to thank Josh for being a guest with us tonight, and that's all I got.
Josh, I would say I enjoyed it. I hope you can come back again.
I would love that. Anytime. I would love that very much.
Yeah, just let me know.
Very good. Have a great night, guys. Appreciate it. Bye.
All right. You too.